Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. In the next 4 years, there will be many battles in Washington as the elites gather round their sacred cows and demand that we all worship them. The issues are countless: taxes, immigration, crime, defense, jobs. On abortion, President Trump has already embraced the Mexico City policy, returning to the sensible practice of refusing to force the American taxpayer to pay for abortions all over the world. Moreover, he will soon request that the Republican Congress write this into permanent law, something which pro-abortion forces on Capitol Hill, thankfully in the minority today, have prohibited for decades but will be able no longer to prohibit. The president's next step will be to remove federal funding from the country's most notorious and aggressive abortion provider, Planned Parenthood. He will also move to protect the states from the demand that they send their own taxpayer funds to this abortion monolith. This move will save many young American lives, which is vitally important, but it will represent a broader move on the part of the average Americans who elected the president with regard to the elites who find them so deplorable. Because for decades, these elites have used the money taken from those deplorables by force to feather their own elitist nests throughout the government and the culture. What is to be done? The late Howard Phillips, a devoted conservative and champion of the family, said it best: defund the left. And there is no leftist bastion more worthy of defunding than the one erected by the radical elites in the institutions that were once called educational: America's colleges, universities, and public schools. Few Americans today recognize that most of our oldest universities began as seminaries, demanding of their graduates a thorough knowledge of Greek, Latin, history, literature, and scripture. Nor are most of us aware that the public school movement began 150 years ago as an integral part of an attack on the Catholic Church. In the mid-19th century, Protestant know-nothings won many elections across the country. For practical purposes, their political platform was one word: anti-Catholic. The know-nothings railed against the millions of newly arrived Catholic immigrants. Most of these newcomers were Europeans, two generations of Irish who had been starved by their English overlords and two government-imposed famines, and German Catholics who had been kicked out by the virulently anti-Catholic Chancellor Bismarck, and many more. All of these immigrants were legal, but that didn't matter to America's anti-Catholic elites. We recall that the Ku Klux Klan's membership comprised at least one-third of prominent businessmen from Pittsburgh all the way through the Midwest to St. Louis in those days, and the Klansmen hated Catholics a lot more than they hated blacks or Jews. Moreover, in the 1980s, Democrats elected one of those Klansmen as their majority leader in the United States Senate. Senator Bobby Byrd of West Virginia was not only a pro-abortion big spender, he was also a former KKK Grand Cyclops who loved to stroll around the Senate floor quoting scripture. But Bobby had to apologize for his bigotry. His predecessors in the 19th century didn't. Not only did they brand these newly arrived Europeans as criminals, they also feared them. After all, these Catholic families had a lot of kids and were starting their own schools, complete with armies of foreign nuns to teach them and papist priests to catechize them. According to Russus Rushduni's History of Education, Horace Mann, who founded the public school movement in Massachusetts in the 1850s, believed that the public schools are the means, instruments, vehicles, and true church by which salvation is given to society, end quote. Given that goal, Mann changed the function of education from mere learning or religiously oriented education to social efficiency, civic virtue and character, end quote. Rushdoony notes that, by the 20th century, character sadly ceased to be a concern in the public schools. That's because Horace Mann's civic virtue morphed into the civil religion advocated by the famous radical philosophe Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the intellectual godfather of the French Revolution and grandfather of the communist ideology. Horace Mann paved the way for this secular enterprise, demanding that control of community schools be transferred into state hands. Who but the government speaks for civic virtue? After all, now virtue means serving not God, but the state. A decade later, and a continent away, another pioneer took up the cause. As California's superintendent of public instruction during the 1860s, John Sweatt was responsible for framing the basic legislation of the state system. Sweatt made his goals perfectly clear. Children arrived at the age of maturity belong not to the parents but to the state, to society, and to the country, he insisted. So children should be educated not according to the beliefs of their parents, but according to those of the government. Now, the civil religion taught in government schools was designed to neutralize the papist heresies taught in parochial schools. Anti-Catholic know-nothings were powerful in the California of that era, and Catholic families were not only the competition, they were the enemy. Catholics were inferiors that had to be raised to the level of civic virtue expected of everyone else by being made less Catholic. Now, Sweatt objected to parents having any role in the education of their children at all. He ended the policy by which parents reviewed teachers every year. Why, the parents even had the final approval to hire and fire teachers. Horrors, that had to go. A rabid Unitarian, Sweatt was so popular with generations of secular government school employees that he is honored even today as the founder of California's most powerful teachers union, which continues to impose Sweatt's radical agenda today on millions of helpless California school children. By the way, California's public schools rank near the bottom in every category of the 50 states. But why should performance matter? After all, school unions don't protect the children. They don't pay union dues. They don't even protect good teachers. Good teachers don't need any protection. It's the bad ones who should be fired, but they can't because the union protects them, whether they can teach or not. But all teachers are forced by state law, often enough, to join the union or pay union dues nonetheless. Of course, there are other motivations. The school cultures have sunk so low that many teachers need legal protection because they fear lawsuits from parents if their children get low grades. The situation is clearly a crisis. Public school teachers are physically assaulted every day in many school districts throughout the country. In fact, in the year 2012, according to the American Psychological Association, hundreds of thousands of public school teachers are victims of physical assault every year. That's 1,000 assaults every day school is in session. Yet under Obama, teachers are forced to discipline students not according to their behavior, but according to their race, or the teacher will be charged with discrimination. And for that, she will need a lawyer. Yes, even though the school unions can't teach, they have lots of lawyers. They also have lots of money. In fact, they receive $250 million per year in mandatory dues, $100 million of which they admit are spent on pure politics. Moreover, California's public employee union pension funds are underfunded to the tune of $1/3 trillion. Catholic schools in California can't get a cent of the millions that Catholic parents pay in taxes, but you can bet that the government bureaucrats will stick it to the taxpayers, including Catholics, and force them to bail out by the hundreds of billions those failing pension funds when their bloated gravy train breaks down. And yet, despite this dismal record, they're the only game in town. The result? Most California public high school graduates need remedial math and English merely to get into community colleges as freshmen. 90% of them do need that, in fact. As Joe Sobran once observed, we used to teach Greek and Latin in public high schools. Now we teach remedial English in college. When we come back, we'll look at the situation in primary and secondary education. This is PRI Review from pop.org. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood abortion liberales Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our Pro-Life Victory Seminars and our Pro-Life Strategy Guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today, we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today, the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now, we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. So far, we've looked at the background of today's public education debacle. Well, what about Catholic education? It's a marvel that in spite of the formidable opposition from diehard bigots over the course of more than a century, Catholics and Catholic schools continued to prosper, all on the local level. After all, Washington had nothing to do with education until well into the 20th century. In fact, as Robert Nisbet once observed in 1913, the year he was born, the only connection the average American had with the federal government was the post office. But then came Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s, and with it, intrusion of the federal government into every aspect of American social and cultural life. At the same time, Roosevelt threatened the Supreme Court, successfully, alas, forcing it to support his destruction of the rights of states and communities to govern their own affairs, including the education of their children. As taxes on Catholic families rose under Roosevelt, Catholics found they needed federal government permission to channel some of the local school taxes they pay to help fund the education of their children. In a series of famous Supreme Court cases from the 1930s, stretching all the way to the early 60s, the court paved the way for the secularization of American public education that has only become even more radicalized ever since. By 1963, even reading the Bible in public schools was found to be unconstitutional by the court, which was led at the time by Chief Justice Earl Warren, whose appointment President Dwight D. Eisenhower later called his biggest mistake. Yes, by the early 1960s, Catholic parents seemed to be out of luck when it came to applying any of their tax dollars to the education of their children. But that was on the level of parochial grade in high schools. For colleges, Catholic education's fortune started to change for the better in 1965, the year the Second Vatican Council ended, when Lyndon Johnson, proclaiming his great society, offered countless billions in taxpayer funds to finance the social justice agenda, and in a move both clever and insidious to fund Catholic higher education, hospitals, and welfare agencies. We'll look at that in the next segment, but let's look at LBJ's overall impact on education for a moment. In order to secure the government's hold on local schools, the school teachers' associations that had once devoted their efforts to improving curricula were inspired by Johnson to become politically active zealots, and partisan zealots as well. Only 10 short years after his Great Society started, their massive support propelled the hapless Jimmy Carter into the White House, and Carter repaid them by creating the Federal Department of Education. Since then, Washington education bureaucrats have spent hundreds of billions of dollars, and they've done nothing but destroy literally thousands of public schools throughout America. Here are just a few random observations considering today's government-funded schools. Public school unions are so afraid of competition that they not only resent families who are not satisfied with government schools, they attack them. Virginia's left-wing governor, Terry McAuliffe, repeatedly vetoes legislation allowing homeschoolers to use the sports facilities their parents pay for. Urged on by the union left, McAuliffe is implementing communist dictator Mao Zedong's death of a thousand cuts to keep children out of their homes and under government control. Now, one of the governor's most valuable allies in this effort is another government operation called the Child Protection Services. This serpentine bureaucracy is everywhere, and it responds to any allegation of abuse, including those that are made anonymously. I have interviewed the representatives of the Child Protection Service in Virginia, and I have learned some pretty interesting facts. First of all, most allegations, that is, most charges, prove to be false. A vast number arise during divorce proceedings, with spouses routinely accusing one another of child abuse of their own children in order to be awarded custody of their children and to get a correspondingly higher payment of alimony from the supposedly guilty partner. Another large component of CPS complaints is explained by a report from the U.S. Department of Justice. It's stunning. It reports that if a child is raised by a single unmarried mother living with her boyfriend, that child is 30 times more likely to be abused during his childhood than a child who is raised at home by two married parents until that child reaches the age of 17. Now, these two scenarios alone, boyfriends abusing children of their live-in girlfriends and divorcing couples, account for the majority of reports of child abuse. Yet, the agency often feels compelled to investigate children in normal homes, that is, real families, in order not to be accused of discriminating against divorcing spouses or those living in abnormally immoral circumstances. That's where homeschoolers come in. In many jurisdictions, take New York, for example, school unions are so afraid of losing students to homeschooling parents that they will report those parents to Child Protection Services, even if their families have received all the proper documentation for homeschooling. Now, I mentioned lawyers already. Here, in this case, it is the accused parents who must hire legal counsel to combat the so-called findings of the taxpayer-funded CPS investigator. Well, these people must be experts. So just what training do these investigators have? I interviewed our local county social services investigators and found that both of them had only one prior professional employment experience. They had worked as babysitters in a daycare center. Moreover, they told me how much they preferred the public schools in our community to homeschoolers. In public school, we can undress the child to make sure there are no bruises, and we never have to tell the parents at all, she gushed. Of course, to do that to the child of a homeschooling family, the agency would have to receive a warrant even to enter the home. And what message does this practice send to the children? Don't trust your parents, and don't tell them. Tell a trustworthy government employee. In one case in our local school system, one teacher, jealous of a colleague's promotion, reported that colleague as an abuser of one of her students because she hugged him. Yes, She had to hire a lawyer, and $2,000 later, the charge was dismissed, as most of them are. In fact, most of the allegations proved to be fallacious, sometimes outrageously so. Nonetheless, the accused families must engage an attorney to protect their rights, to protect themselves. However, the CPS is protected by law from being sued, nor is it required to reveal the name of accusers, even if those accusations prove to be false. Now, when the shoe is on the other foot, volunteers at churches like our local parish are designated as mandated reporters, which means that we are required to report our suspicions, even though they will cause the irreversible process to start grinding away. Well, what if we're wrong? We've caused a family irreparable harm. Frankly, some reports are made simply because the intimidated volunteer doesn't want to be charged with failure to report. When I called Virginia's 24-hour child abuse line, Tina, the helpful CPS agent, told me, well, it's always better to make the report. Yep, and Leviathan will rev its engines. After all, your anonymity will be assured. But if you're ever sued for making a false report, you have to hire your own lawyer to defend you, even if you could have been brought to trial yourself had you not made a report of that suspicion. Yes, folks, that's why lawyers love the Child Protection Service. And for the same reason, teachers' unions hate our new education secretary, Betsy DeVos, because she wants to save children from the dumbed-down, feel-good, politicized curriculum of many failing public schools and let parents, not the state, choose what's best for their child. This is the first major step towards family freedom since John Sweat began his frontal assault exactly 150 years, but the unions are outraged. Now, Lily Eskelson Garcia, the new president of the National Education Union, labels any of Donald Trump's statements bullying. So she tells teachers to keep all of the president's statements out of the classroom. Of course, these teachers are welcome to criticize Trump as they virtually revered Obama every day in class. That's today's version of public education. And that's not all. The feminist ideologues push vulgar sex education classes, and punish naturally active boys with Ritalin. And 12 years of their browbeating goes a long way to explain why the National Mental Health Alliance reports that mental health issues are rampant on college campuses. In fact, the Alliance reports that 1 in 4 young adults between the ages of 18 to 24 have a diagnosable mental illness. The list goes on and on. A quarter century ago, education professor William Kirk Kilpatrick found that in 1948, teachers listed their top problems as students running in the halls, not using the wastebasket, or chewing gum. 40 years later, rape, drugs, assaults on teachers, and shootings on and off school grounds, and it's only gotten worse. In fact, Dr. Kilpatrick has written the best book on this dismal situation I've ever read, and I recommend it. It's called Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong. It's a masterpiece. This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. By now, we all know that Planned Parenthood is accused in the United States of allegedly violating the law by, among other atrocities, selling baby body parts. But what you might not realize is that Planned Parenthood's affiliates, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, and International Planned Parenthood Federation, IPPF, are still getting away with murder overseas. Around the world, and especially in Latin America, the baby-killing giant shades the truth about its abortion-related activities. It runs roughshod over local anti-abortion laws and violates local pro-life sentiment, all with seeming impunity. but not anymore. With your tax-deductible gift, PRI will throw the book at the abortion giants overseas, just as pro-life groups are doing here at home. Did you know that PPFA spends about $38 million a year lobbying to legalize abortion in countries around the world? If they're successful, they can kill as many, if not more, babies overseas as they do in the United States. But there's a hitch. Because abortion remains illegal in most Latin American countries, neither IPPF nor PPFA is eligible for government funding for abortion-related activities as they are in the United States. So PPFA, IPPF, gets around it as only they know how to do, by lying. With a wink and a nod, they disguise the programs they are funding as, quote, education or health programs, women's right, human rights protection or promotion, and anti-discrimination initiatives aimed at protecting vulnerable groups such as women or LGBTs, that means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, end quote. Catholic bishops throughout Africa and Latin America complain about this. They call it ideological imperialism, but their voices are not heard in Congress because America's bishops depend on billions in government funding for their own charities. They don't want to bite the political hand that feeds them. Now, PRI receives no government funding, so we aren't hampered by a golden handcuff. That's why your tax-deductible gift to PRI is so important today. As the lead group investigating Planned Parenthood's activities overseas, PRI's Latin American office has uncovered PPFA's thinly disguised efforts to undermine pro-life laws and legitimate abortion on demand. But we've only found the tip of the iceberg, and there is more work to be done, work that we can't do alone. Your tax-deductible gift will help PRI hire a seasoned pro-life legal team to help us expose, investigate, and prosecute Planned Parenthood's affiliates everywhere they prey on women, especially overseas. Together, we'll expose, investigate, and prosecute PPFA and IPPF everywhere it tries to hide the truth. This two-prong attack, complementing the hearings taking place in Washington, will force Planned Parenthood to fight on two fronts. What better way to strike a blow against the real Planned Parenthood, the one we saw in all those horrific videos, than to come at them here and abroad? So please make a tax-deductible gift to support this and all of PRI's baby-saving efforts around the world. Yes, they're powerful. Yes, they're big. But remember, David and Goliath. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. Now let's look at the government's control of higher education. For colleges, Catholic fortunes started to change in Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. He offered countless billions in taxpayer funds to colleges so long as they hewed to the social justice agenda of the left. Very quickly, Catholic colleges put their faith on the shelf and teamed up in a lobbyist coalition designed to get as much taxpayer funding as they could get. All this came at a price, and Notre Dame, my alma mater, paid it immediately. For 120 years, Notre Dame had been governed by the priests of the Holy Cross Order that founded it. But in the 1960s, the university quickly laicized its board to become eligible for taxpayer funding. To make their position even clearer, the university joined several other Catholic institutions and signed the Land O'Lakes Charter, declaring their independence from Rome, the Holy Father, and traditional Catholic teaching, all so they could lobby Congress for more taxpayer dollars. And lobby they did. Today, while Notre Dame proudly proclaims its independence from the Church, it is quick to comply dutifully with every directive, however capricious or onerous, from the federal bureaucracy that provides so much of its funding. After Obama appeared at Notre Dame's commencement in 2009, Notre Dame had a record year of fundraising because of a $30 million taxpayer-funded grant that came in from the Obama government a few months later. Notre Dame serves as a microcosm reflecting what has gone on everywhere ever since. In Catholic dioceses, colleges, universities, hospitals, and welfare agencies that it calls charities. To be sure, several brave bishops strived mightily to curb the excesses, the sidelining of the fundamentals of the faith, and often the outright rebellion among chancery bureaucracies and tenured faculties of formerly Catholic institutions. But those few bishops largely failed, mostly because they were hesitant to exercise their full and genuine authority to protect the faith and the faithful. Since the 1960s, these Catholic institutions have received tens of billions of taxpayer dollars, an emolument now considered by bishops to be indispensable, given the decline in Sunday collections and the departure of 30 million Catholics from the Church. And the sex abuse and cover-up scandals sure didn't help. Quickly, bishops turned to professional lobbyists and public relations experts, many of whom were profoundly opposed to Catholic teaching, but they were experts, and they pursued and preserved that income by getting it from the government. Meanwhile, most of the faithful were totally unaware that this taxpayer funding of their bishops even exists. Of course, the bishops are aware, but only rarely do they bother to tell the people in the pews. And while Catholic bishops undoubtedly believe that they receive this funding because they are such good guys, anyone on Capitol Hill can tell you that every dollar of federal funding comes with a price tag. And what is that price for America's Catholic bishops? Well, consider, most Catholic bishops are about my age, and like me, most grew up in Democrat households. When they entered the seminary at high school or college age, their studies concentrated on a mastery of philosophy, theology, biblical studies, church history, and apologetics. What little they knew about politics, they brought with them from home. Today, they constantly crusade for the agenda of the party we all grew up with. Global warming, amnesty for illegal aliens, raising the minimum wage, Obamacare, minus abortion coverage, of course, and massive funding for failed poverty programs, increased foreign aid, including billions for family planning, and the rest of the Democrats' social justice agenda. This crusade goes hand in hand with a policy of silence regarding any possible criticism of Catholic politicians who champion abortion rights. Now, this has all been going on for quite a while, of course. In fact, the first grant that the newly minted neighborhood organizer Barack Obama received long ago came from the Catholic Archdiocese of Chicago. Most U.S. bishops have been critical of President-elect Donald Trump. It's an open question whether they will be able to work with him to reverse the hostile anti-Catholic policies of the Obama administration on the one hand, if they are afraid of losing the billions in government funding on the other. Are things any different on non-Catholic campuses? Hardly. We've all read about the pervasive muzzling of students by the politically correct tenured radicals. The left-wing agenda has infected not only the classroom and the campus, but even college sports. After all, the NCAA is merely a subsidiary of college administrations anyway. So their threats to boycott states that protect girls from dirty old men in bathrooms merely reflect their obedience to the college ideologues who supply the athletes. Moreover, all colleges and universities that seek federal funding have to pay for it with obedience not to parents, not to the taxpayer, but to the federal bureaucrats that hand out the money. And even though higher education receives countless billions a year from the taxpayer, many of those same taxpayers can't afford college because tuitions have been rising three times as fast as inflation for over the 50 years since LBJ. Notre Dame's tuition was $1,600 a year in 1967. 50 years later, it is more than 30 times that figure. And how do all these universities get this federal cash? They hire lobbyists. A few of them are friends of mine. These guys make millions while they bring in billions for their clients. And universities that really want to sell out to the feds hire not educators, but politicians as their presidents, because they know how to get the money. So New York University, the University of Texas, Oklahoma, and Cal Berkeley, just to name a few, have followed that path. Well, how's it working out for Cal Berkeley? Frankly, the place is an especially craven example. Its president, Janet Napolitano, was actually Obama's secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Yet, just a few weeks later, when college Republicans at Berkeley invited a speaker, this so-called security expert president provided no security and virtually encouraged gangs of anarchists wearing black masks who attacked students attending the lecture, criminally assaulting several of them and sending some to the hospital. Meanwhile, Cal Berkeley police had orders not to interfere, not to arrest any felons, and ultimately to cancel the appearance because, get this, there was not enough security. So much for a president of all the university students. Leftist college professors routinely attack big business and the powerful, but they are patently hypocrites. Consider the average classroom. The teacher has a lot more power over the student than any corporate CEO does. Can the CEO of Citibank ruin your chances of getting into a top-ranked college? No. Well, a third-rate, washed-up high school union teacher can. Aggrieved love-in leftovers love to fail those bright and very brave students who show them up in class. They call it social justice. I call it criminal. Same thing goes for the rest of your life. The rich can't keep you from going to Harvard Business School, although your better judgment might. But a spiteful professor in your college major? He can. It's spelled D. And these tyrants don't see a no admittance sign on the Catholic schoolhouse door. Some of the worst malefactors are the fallen away Catholic teachers on a mission. They scorn the faithful students who haven't lost their faith yet. I worked my way through grad school playing music in roadhouses. There, one feminist teacher from a major Catholic university once bragged to me that if she couldn't corrupt the altar boy types any other way, she'd seduce them. That is sheer hateful spite of the destructive leftist variety. Socrates tells us that the teacher must love his student more than the student loves himself. Where that virtue is absent, the teacher is a tyrant. And inside every budding tyrant eager to save the world is a constellation of envy, hubris, and diabolical destruction of limits, a contempt for metaphysics, contempt for definitions themselves. Confucius advocated the preservation of the proper meaning of words. The tyrant seeks to destroy them. This charade has simply got to stop. This is PRI Review from pop.org. Thanks for listening.